Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Tuesday, April 21st, and today we are diving into the remote Scott Reef in the Timor Sea. Today we are going to be talking with three engineers from Australia Centre for Robotics in University of Sydney. They have been coordinating underwater robotics in the Timor Sea for the last week. We will reach Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel Falkor all the way off Australia's coast through satellite connection. First up, we'll talk with Chief Scientist Oscar Pizarro, Research Fellow at the Australian Centre for Field Robotics. He is an oceanographic engineer who specializes in underwater imaging from robotic platforms. Oscar, are you with us?
I'm here. Hi, Carly.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be on here.
So, you've been very busy for the last week, and I think you have another week out at sea. Can you first tell us a little bit about this cruise? What inspired you to do a robotics expedition?
Yeah, it's been pretty busy, and we're getting to the last bit of the cruise, and it's gone quite well so far. The original motivation for this was with this idea of, that we've had with several of our colleagues, many of which are on board, that robotics is quite useful for oceanography, but there are limited opportunities to develop new techniques and test new ways of doing things while these machines and these systems are being used to do science. So we came up with the idea of requesting ship time to just do development work, which is not necessarily that rare, but it's a bit of a luxury for an engineer to have, you know, a couple of weeks at sea to basically just try things out without the additional requirement of producing science deliverables on a tight schedule, working for a science program.
And the types of robotics that you're working on, can you share what they are and how many you have on board? What are you doing with all of them?
There's a bunch of vehicles here. So to take the previous question a bit further, so in this context of a development cruise, the motivation was to have robotics used more effectively and to provide a better use of ship time by basically augmenting the capabilities of a ship using several platforms, as well as looking into how these platforms can work together with or without a ship nearby. And these are trends that are seeable now. We can confidently say that in some point in the future we will expect ships to have one or many of these platforms and try to get more out of their time at sea, and that in some cases specialized platforms will operate on their own without necessarily a ship full of people and expensive people, by the way, and operations being there. So in this case, we gathered a bunch of vehicles from different groups and we were going to try them. So there's a group of underwater imaging platforms that take pictures of the seafloor. So we have three robots of that kind. You can tell them where to go, and they will follow particular tracks and at a certain altitude from the bottom. There's a simplified version of that, which is a float that drifts but takes pictures of the seafloor at a given altitude. So the imaging quality is good, but it goes where it goes based on the currents, which is a in some ways, it's a different approach, but it's quite interesting because it tells you what's happening in terms of the flow regime in an area, and you can at the same time explore what's down in the bottom. And in addition, we have a glider that traverses the water column and can be used to sample the what's in between the surface and the bottom, and in this case, we have a modified version of this that has a sonar that allows it to map while it's doing this, which is a rather unique capability, and will produce some interesting improvements in the way these platforms that are very limited in power can figure out where they are while they're underwater. They usually are good at that on the surface, but not so much when they're underwater.
So it sounds like
there's a weight. Sorry.
I was going to say, it just sounds like each one of them has a very different role. And how do you select which one to use on a particular day, or do you use them all at the same time?
I left out one more there. Sorry to round up the picture. Was the wave glider that is always on the surface, and it's solar powered for its electronics, but its motion is powered by waves. And we are using that as a sort of mini Falkor, in that it can track some of the vehicles, and we can talk to it. So it gives us some of the capabilities we expect from Falkor from a small platform. And as you asked, yeah, they have very different capabilities. In general, we've been trying to use them together in the sense that they are all converged in an area, and we try to complement their capabilities. So, for instance, we can have the float drifting over an area of interest, and in the same area being mapped in a more traditional way with a structured grid of that. Then these two vehicles will have a slightly different view of what that area was. And that's an interesting question. If you have a high intensity, very systematic survey of an area and you want to understand what's there, how does that vary versus the case where you just so a relatively simple robot that gives you a sparser understanding of that area, but potentially could be more cost-effective in some scenarios, or it could be used to decide if you need to do a more intensive approach. And in general, we've kept the wave glider operating in the same general area, but trying to not get right in the middle of the action, and at some points just it starts to look a bit like a traffic controller situation in an airport. It's been interesting. But in general, we're trying to keep all the assets in the water as much as we can, and learning from that part of how do you do that? How do you best use the time you have when your limited time you have when you're on a ship?
I can't imagine that'd be difficult, and I'm sorry I cut you off there before you got to tell us about the wave glider. That's actually my favorite one. I've been following all the robotics online. You have that really cool website where you can see where all the different robots are and when they're in the water, and so the wave glider was my favorite. There were some great images. So do you have a favorite of all of them?
They all have their good sides and they're not so good sides, I guess. They're quirks and personalities in some way. But I have to agree, the wave glider is certainly a step in the right direction, in that we have basically left it out for days at a time, and we know where it is, and it kind of plods along. It takes time sometimes. We've been very lucky with the weather here, and so there's literally no waves, very calm seas, which makes it great when you're putting things in and out of the water often, and don't have to fight the difficult conditions to recover and deploy or even spot things on the surface once they come back. But at the same time, for a vehicle that's propelled by waves, it means it doesn't necessarily go fast anywhere. But it shows up eventually, and it's quite good that way, that you can follow it through Iridium, so it doesn't have to be that close to the ship. It's a fun platform for that type of stuff.
And they're nice, and of course, bright colors, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of bright yellow, oceanographic yellow on board at the moment.
So now, Oscar, when we talk about underwater robotics, we hear a lot of people reference ROVs and AUVs. Can you explain the difference between the two and maybe some of the advantages or disadvantages to one over the other?
Mm, Sure. So I'll explain it in the traditional sense, and then this has changed a bit over time more recently. But the traditional division is that an ROV, standing for a remotely operated vehicle, is one that's piloted by a person, and that's traditionally done with a tether. So there's power, and there's command signals, and all the sensor data is moving from between the vehicle to the surface. So the ship that where you are powers the vehicle, and there's a pilot on the ship, or potentially could even be off the ship through a satellite link, that has some advantages. One of them is that you're not limited by batteries, so you can stay down for very long times. And in fact, in many cases, they are operated on a shift system, so you have crews on board that just rotate, and you can keep the asset underwater for a very long period. And then there's the advantage of having a human in the loop, which is particularly good if you're exploring, if you're doing some form of intervention where you need fine manipulation tasks and understand the complex situation or perform experiments, collect samples. A lot of those things can be done with robots that are guided by people at the moment. It's quite hard to do them completely autonomously. And then they say serve a good role there. AUVs, on the other side, typically we think of them as being, and then the acronym stands for autonomous underwater vehicles, that they're untethered and they tend to be powered, have their own energy source, so typically a battery system. And they can stay, if therefore they're limited, they can't stay underwater indefinitely, but they're quite good at performing tasks that are rather tedious and away from a ship. So you don't have to have a big, expensive ship next to it. It can be sent off to do their own thing, and they can do things that a person would tend to get bored or just not stick to the plan. So if you want to do systematically cover an area like mowing the lawn, it's much easier for a machine to follow a pre-programmed pattern than to ask a person to stick to that when they see something interesting and they want to go and check it out. And so they have niches and that are quite complementary. You could think of having a broad understanding on area with AUVs and then picking sites that you could go and check out more carefully with people. And that distinction is the difference between ROVs and AUVs has blurred a bit in the last few years. There are several examples now of vehicles that are hybrid between the two, so they can operate as either. And one of the tricks that allows that is to have battery systems on the vehicle and just a very fine fiber optic tether to the surface, so a person can control it and through the fiber and can see what the vehicle is seeing. But it also makes for the deployment and the operations a bit more flexible, given that you don't have a big cable to support the weight. And that is particularly useful if you're operating in very deep waters, which is one of the initial examples of this done by Nereus at Hui, or if you're looking at operating under ice away from the ship rather than straight down, you can move laterally long distances. That's another nice property of hybrid vehicles.
And on the ship now that you're working with, those are AUVs that you have been focusing on for this particular cruise.
In general, yes, the drifter float is a bit of a odd man out in that it only controls its vertical motion up and down, and with the drift it's set to just go where the currents go. Basically, it can't decide that. So it's kind of like an AUV where you've taken away its ability to move in the horizontal plane, or to choose to move in a particular direction. But yeah, in general, they would all be considered autonomous underwater vehicles. And the wave glider doesn't really go underwater, so it would be an autonomous surface vehicle, an AFV.
And a lot of these vehicles that you're working with are focused on taking some images. And you also mentioned that you specialize in underwater imaging capabilities. So what's the advantage of using a robotic vehicle? Like, why not send some divers down with cameras? What's the difference?
Good question. And it's a bit similar to the ROV-AUV distinction. So when you need to have the human mind involved, it's good to have a diver there. So if they're exploring, the task is quite complex and it requires manipulation, if it's some fine experiment where a person's ability to understand what's happening around them and use their motor skills, a diver is quite appropriate. The flip side is that you're putting people at risk. There's always a chance something could go wrong when you're diving, and if that's the case, the consequences could be at least significant. There's also a limit to how deep people can dive regularly and safely. So beyond 30 meters, it starts to get more and more complicated in terms of getting into technical diving and the risks that are involved. And even below 30 meters in shallow waters, many research organizations nowadays are concerned and about the health and safety aspects of this and make it quite difficult to normally do science in a regular way. You really have to have a good reason to want to put somebody in the water, which is understandable.
Sure.
So that's one side of it. The other downside, I guess, of divers in particular, and men are when you're trying to do science that has where the spatial aspect of what you're observing and what you're studying is important, is that it's pretty hard to figure out where a diver went and took a picture. It's much easier to instrument properly a robot that can georeference. It tell you where every observation was taken to fairly high precision, and to do so in a systematic and repeatable manner. So for taking images in the water, it's quite nice to do so if you're mapping an area at a consistent altitude. So you tend to stay at the right imaging altitude to get the right quality, the right illumination. Person tends to have to eyeball that, and that makes it a bit more difficult. And again, if it's a task that's kind of tedious and monotonous, then a machine may be more suited than a person.
Definitely. You can have the robotics go down for a lot longer than someone on a dive tank, that's for sure. Well, it's also been really interesting to follow the crews along and read the blogs and really learn a little bit more about the AUV. So I really appreciate you taking some time out of the busy crew schedule to talk with us today and share your experiences. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we are going to learn more about these underwater robotic adventures.
Steve Tam attended the recent Alzheimer's Association Advocacy Forum in Washington, D.C.
to honor my father, who passed away from Alzheimer's, my mother-in-law, who passed away from dementia, and also my uncle.
The advocates are fighting for an increase of $300 million for Alzheimer's research.
There's probably about 25,000 people in Hawaii with Alzheimer's and over 64,000 caregivers.
Alzheimer's is the costliest disease to U.S. society. To learn more about Alzheimer's, visit ALZ.org.
Save precious babies from abortion and get a maximum tax deduction when you donate any vehicle, running or not, to Christian Family Charities. Just call 521-4438. That's 521-4438. We'll pick up your vehicle within 24 hours. You get the maximum tax deduction. You've helped a mother and saved a precious baby. Call 521-4438 or go to ChristianFamilyCharities.org. 521-4438. Give a vehicle and the gift of life to a precious unborn baby.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. With us now is Dr. Stefan Williams, professor at the Australian Centre for Field Robotics at the University of Sydney. He's also the head of Australia's Integrated Marine Observing System Autonomous Underwater Vehicle Facility. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Carly. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. It sounds like you have had a very busy week filled with lots of unique testing of all these vehicles. And we had the chance to talk to Oscar a little bit about the types of vehicles that you've been using. But what we didn't get to talk about was the area that you're in. So can you start by telling us a little bit about Scott Reef and why this area was selected for this cruise?
Yeah, we're at Scott Reef. It's about 400 kilometers north of Broome, so it's tropical up near the equator. It's part of an oceanic shoals region on the northwest shelf of Australia, which has some pretty unique biology, like, you know, some spectacular coral reefs up here. It's also an economically important area where there's some oil and gas. So understanding, you know, the habitats out here and what the environment is like, documenting that has been seen as a bit of a priority, and so we've been coming to Scott Reef. This is our third trip here as part of the IMOS AUV facility program. We do repeat surveys where we try to help scientists understand how these sorts of document what's here and understand how these sorts of environments are maybe changing through time.
And is this the only site that you're looking at, or do you look at other sites as well?
Yeah, we work all around Australia. So we work with a number of different research organizations, both government at the state and federal level, and also other university partners. And through that, we've identified a number of key ecological features that are being monitored on an annual basis with these AUV systems. So we go back to these sites, we run the AUVs, collecting imagery, building three-dimensional models of the seafloor, and then we publish all of that data so scientists can get in, have a look at what's on the seafloor, understand the questions around things like marine parks and their effectiveness, see how benthic habitats are responding to changes in the oceanography, which is another part of the whole IMOS program, understand physical drivers, which we're seeing sort of the biological response using these AUV systems.
And when you look at these photos that are being collected, I'm sure in mass there's a ton of them. Is there anything in particular you're looking for, or what kind of information are you extracting from the photos?
So typically what happens is we'll deploy the vehicle and it will collect usually tens of thousands of images in a single dive. So we'll come back from this trip with, I'd estimate, at least 500,000 images. And one of the things that I guess scientists are trying to extract from the data is estimates of percent cover, health of different major benthic habitat-forming organisms, like coral reefs in this case, although in more temperate areas, we do a lot of work around kelp forests as well. But the scientists will then take the imagery and they'll go through and do an analysis of some small portion of those images, identify things in the imagery, you know, calculate statistics over the dives that we've done. But to help with that process, we've been doing a lot of work recently on automated classification, where we use expert input to help to train a computer to start recognizing things in the imagery. We also have techniques that are unsupervised, which look for sort of similar or unusual things in the imagery on their own. And I guess one of the initiatives we've been pushing this trip, and we've done it in the past as well, is using citizen science input, so actually having people have a look through the imagery, help us provide labels to train these machine learning classification algorithm.
And I have to say that's actually very addicting. I've gone onto the Squiddle site, which we'll talk about a little later in the show, and started to tag a few ones just to see what it was about. And you kind of, it's almost like a video game. You do one, then you're like, all right, I want to see what's on the next one. So I can see where, you know, there's an element of surprise and excitement and what kind of photos you get. Have you ever been surprised? Has an AUV image caught something really amazing in all the times that you've been looking through the photos?
It's always, you know, it's pretty exciting to see a lot of the things on the seafloor, particularly in deeper depths where, you know, we're really not sure what's going to be there. We've seen amazing sponge gardens sort of in deep waters,
I've seen a few areas where we've seen, you know, bottom-dwelling sharks, and, you know, occasionally we'll see things like anchors and things like that. I think probably at one point some of our colleagues said, well, you know, it's great, we take lots of pictures of the bottom, but what's happening around the AUV Wild Center Way, we're really interested in understanding that. So we've started putting cameras looking around the vehicle, and we see some amazing things, and, you know, seals and big sharks and sea snakes following the vehicle around. It seems to be, you know, a lot of interest in the AUV as it cruises along, so it's pretty spectacular seeing some of this.
I can imagine a yellow robot in the water taking pictures would probably be very interesting to a lot of marine organisms. And what first got you interested in underwater robotics? I mean, is this something you've always wanted to do, or how did you sort of transition into this role?
Yeah, I guess, you know, growing up, I was always interested by, I guess, some of the BBC, and there was a Canadian naturalist who had a lot of, you know, the shows and sort of documentaries about natural systems, in particular the marine area, caught my eye. I didn't pursue a biology background, but went into engineering. Got interested in robotics. Also sort of had an interest in that maybe as a kid, but that developed through my engineering training. And then I came to Australia about 17 years ago to pursue a PhD. The lab, the Australian Centre for Field Robotics, was a couple of years old. They were just finding their feet, and they said, well, we've got projects with unmanned air vehicles and ground platforms, and we have a small marine systems group, which is, you know, was just in its infancy, that had a couple of undergraduate student projects and a couple of PhD students working on things. And I thought, in Australia, that seems like a pretty good area to work in. So I made that the focus of my PhD, and then opportunities came up to stay on, and we've really grown it from that relatively small beginnings into an internationally renowned program. We're well known for the type of imaging work that we do in building models. And, you know, a large part of that is ecological assessment, but we've also started getting involved in archaeological work. So we've worked in Greece and Sicily and in deep water imaging work in the U.S. and Japan. So we're getting invitations from all around the world to actually take this technology that we've developed and apply it to better understand our environment and, I guess, cultural heritage as well.
What such interesting topics to apply the technology to. I'm sure some of that archaeological work is fascinating. Now, I know you also have expressed interest in mapping what it says, unstructured underwater environments. So I guess my first question is, what exactly is an unstructured underwater environment, and how do you go about doing that?
So I guess traditionally in robotics, you know, if you have a robot operating in an office building, there's a lot of structure in that environment. There's walls, you know, and, you know, lots of flat surfaces, and the modeling problem can be abstracted to, you know, estimating where these flat linear surfaces are. But underwater, you don't see a lot of these sorts of things. So we really need to use the imagery in order to get good maps covering broad areas. We need to be able to use the imagery to find features so the robot can actually recognize that it's been in a particular area and adjust the map that we're building to make the data self-consistent. So I do have some examples of those types of maps available through an iPad app, for example. You can see the sort of level of detail that we're building. We actually have to use the data to build high-fidelity, three-dimensional models of these environments where we can't beforehand predict anything about the structure of what's going to be there. It's sort of a natural process that builds these reef systems.
Interesting. And, you know, I asked Oscar this question, but I'm going to have to go ahead and ask you as well. Is there a favorite AUV or robotic vehicle that you like to work with? I feel like, you know, each one of them does something so different. You know, you got to have a favorite.
Yeah, I got a soft spot for Sirius, which is our workhorse, the main vehicle that we've been using about 10 years old now, which is relatively old by AUV standards. It's done probably, many hundreds, if not a thousand, in excess of 1,000 dives, and collected millions of images from all around the world on the seafloor. Just keeps chugging along. On this particular trip, I've been coordinating some of the multi-vehicle coordination aspects, but also spending a lot of time getting a small torpedo-shaped vehicle up and running, and that's been a bit of a challenge. There's been a few issues with it, but we had it in the water yesterday, and I'm hoping to get out today again. And we're in the process of actually designing a new vehicle to take over from Sirius as we think about its dotage and, what we're going to do in the long term with it. We're sort of transitioning to vehicles that are a little bit smaller and easier to deploy from smaller vessels, which will give us access to more areas and be a little bit more, deployable in with small boats.
Mm-hmm. And are vehicles like Sirius, I know who's working with you all, or you're working on Sirius on Falkor, but at the Integrated Marine Observing System back in Australia, or your home base, are there many AUVs that you work with there? Are there specific ones?
Sirius is the main one. It's run by the IMOS AUV facility, so that's been the workhorse for that. There are a few other groups around Australia using AUVs, but I think the IMOS program has really afforded us with enough funding to have the vehicle operating order 80 to 90 days a year. We're out running the AVs, collecting data for scientists, and I think that's the main workhorse of the vehicle at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And are you going out with the AUV Sirius every time? So how often are you out at sea with these vehicles?
I've been out on a lot of the trips recently, so I'll probably go on about half of the trips. But we have technical staff who are responsible for sort of logistics and operations and maintenance. And they're also getting involved in sort of designing improvements and new versions of these vehicles.
And is there anything you really like about going out to sea, or has there been something special that's sort of stood out for this trip? What's it like traveling on Falkor?
Falkor is a very nice boat. It's very comfortable, very good amenities. It's nice sitting in a nice library area at the moment. The weather's been absolutely phenomenal. We've had glassy calm for the last couple of weeks. I think I enjoy the sense of adventure and going to do things that, see bits of the seafloor and do things that nobody's ever done before. I like the fact that we're contributing to answering important scientific questions and the opportunity to work with some very clever people at organizations both around Australia and overseas is something I value a lot.
And is your day, most of us can't imagine just being out at sea on a ship with all these different robots and putting them in the water and testing them. What does a typical day look like for you? Are you doing the same things every day, or do different vehicles get tested on different days?
Yeah, on this particular trip, I think it's a little bit unusual in having the number of platforms, the variety of platforms that we have available here, and coordinating those activities and having, we're starting now to think about how to automate some of that process. It's, making sure that the vehicles are not putting themselves or the ship in danger is something that we're working on. The days are long. We're starting at typically about 6 in the morning with a meeting up on the bridge with the captain and crew to discuss the day's activities. We've been nominally putting Sirius in the water around 7 for 3 or 4 hours. We'll recover it after that. But while it's underway doing its thing, then the float's being deployed. We've got the surface vessel cruising around. The Slocum glider's being deployed. And one of the things that the guys are trying to do now is automate the planning so that we're trying to ensure that the glider doesn't come up where it's not expected, that it respects sort of an exclusion zone around where all the other platforms are operating. So that's pretty exciting stuff. We're starting to do some automated planning.
Well, it definitely sounds like you're accomplishing a lot in one day, more than most of us. That's exciting.
Mm, yeah, well, a 6 a.m. start, and it typically, well, after midnight by the time we wrap it up and call it a day. So, yeah, long days.
But yeah, long days, but hopefully it's worth it. And it sounds like you guys are going to be getting a lot of images as well as some of this data. Sure. So what are the next steps after?
And we'll make that all, and we'll certainly make all that data available through, you know, we have a variety of online portals and things where the data will appear. And the Squiddle site, which I think you're about to talk to Ari about, is one way that people can interact with this sort of data.
Yeah, so I guess that was one of my, you know, last questions for you is, you have these outlets, these websites where people can assist with some of the data, but it sounds like there is just a mass amount of information that comes off one of these cruises from each individual underwater robotic. So how do you process or organize all of that data?
So we carry a number of servers while we're in the field with you know, many terabytes of storage. We're very careful about organizing the imagery and associated navigation data from the vehicles into you know, folders that are tagged by dive and the time we took the images. So that allows us to automate the process of downloading the data off the vehicle, processing it into the meshes and you know, final imagery, and then uploading that online to these web portals. So, you know, we have developed software systems that allow us to manage this data quite effectively and efficiently. And then once we get back to shore, we'll have a, you know, quality control look over the data, and then we'll send that off to the IMOS office. There's an electronic marine infrastructure facility as part of IMOS, and they manage sort of the long-term archiving and making sure that all the data collected by IMOS is available to the community.
Well, it certainly sounds like you have your work cut out for you, and it sounds like you'll have a very busy Easter weekend, spending lots of time with the robotics. Yeah. Maybe you could have some egg hunts with Sirius and the Wave Glider and all of them, but I'm really looking forward to seeing some of the data and results that come from your efforts. So thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us.
Thanks,
and taking
Charlie.
Some time. We'll come right back and talk a little bit more about some of this image tagging and website work with these underwater vehicles, so stay tuned.
Steve Tam attended the recent Alzheimer's Association Advocacy Forum in Washington, D.C.
to honor my father, who passed away from Alzheimer's, my mother-in-law, who passed away from dementia, and also my uncle.
The advocates are fighting for an increase of $300 million for Alzheimer's research.
There's probably about 25,000 people in Hawaii with Alzheimer's and over 64,000 caregivers.
Alzheimer's is the costliest disease to U.S. society. To learn more about Alzheimer's, visit ALZ.org.
Save precious babies from abortion and get a maximum tax deduction when you donate any vehicle, running or not, to Christian Family Charities. Just call 521-4438. That's 521-4438. We'll pick up your vehicle within 24 hours. You get the maximum tax deduction. You've helped a mother and saved a precious baby. Call 521-4438 or go to ChristianFamilyCharities.org. 521-4438. Give a vehicle and the gift of life to a precious unborn baby.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Last but certainly not least, we have Dr. Ariel Friedman. Ariel is a postdoc researcher and engineer working at the Australian Centre for Field Robotics at the University of Sydney. He has degrees in mechatronics engineering, commerce as well, and a PhD in the area of machine learning and computer vision. Ari, I'm very excited to talk to you about some of this background and some of the exciting work you've been doing on Falkor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carly. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what an interesting background. I'm so curious to talk to you a little bit about how you first got interested in robotics or engineering.
I guess I always just thought robots were cool. I think even from a young age, my parents always used to get angry with me because I used to break my toys just to kind of figure out how they work. And I think we're still doing that now, I had this sort of realization the other day where we were dumping the robots off the side of the ship into the water and getting them to dive, that we're pretty much doing the same thing. We're just throwing our toys off the side, except the toys are just a little bit more expensive. And I think I've always been interested in just figuring out how things work. So that's kind of how I got into robotics and engineering.
Yes, I'm sure there are a lot of little boys and girls all around looking at what you guys do and just envious at all the fun projects that you're working with in terms of the robots on board. And how does the commerce degree come into all of that?
It doesn't really. I think the one thing the commerce degree did was tell me how much I enjoy, well, help solidify how much I enjoy engineering over commerce. So I think that's pretty much its contribution.
Well, that's important too. It's important to diversify and figure out exactly what you like.
yeah, exactly.
And your doctoral area of research, the machine learning and computer vision, that, you know, a lot of people probably don't have experience with that or even really know what that entails. Can you explain a little bit about what that actually is?
Yeah, sure. So we sort of take a lot for granted when we're able to sort of see the world around us and to see the things that we look at. If we look at a photograph, we can identify objects in the photograph quite easily. We're able to sort of make sense of the world around us. But when you put a photograph on a computer, all the computer knows is it's a blending, basically just a bunch of pixels. And so there's an extra step needed for the computer to actually understand what's in the image. And that's really where those two fields come in, computer vision and machine learning. It's basically giving the computer some ability to perceive and make sense of what's in the image, rather than just a bunch of colored pixels that can actually try to work out the content in the images. And so the machine learning part is about training an algorithm to be able to do that automatically.
So Ari, tell me, what intrigues you about working in the marine environment? How do you apply that robotics and computer programming background to our oceans?
Well, going back onto the machine learning and computer vision aspect, it's very challenging underwater because one of the things about taking images underwater is the illumination and the lighting. Is very inconsistent, and you have a wavelength-dependent attenuation, so the red wavelengths drop off, and so the images generally tend to look greeny, green or blue. And so trying to identify things in images, it makes it a lot more challenging. And so I think having, the programming comes in because all these algorithms are basically methods that need to be implemented in a program that can actually do the analysis. So, I think there is a lot of programming involved in robotics and in working with all these different computer algorithms. Because you need to code them up and you need to test them and you need to check that they're working and it's a lot of programming.
And not only is it programming, but you've done something really unique in taking some of these very cool data sets from the robots and making them publicly available and getting a lot of public interest on them. So you've done a couple sites that have been on this particular cruise, and the first of them has been this tracking site where you can actually see which vehicles are in the water and where they are in relation to into Falkor. What gave you the idea to do that?
Well, that was sort of the result of something that started out with a very different objective. The original plan was we needed some way of keeping track of all of our vehicles, multi-vehicle deployments, because that's something that we haven't really done before, which is have so many robotic platforms from different institutions all on the same ship going into the water at the same time, and we needed a way of keeping track of where everything was, not just for cool visualization purposes, but actually these robots are quite expensive, and you need to keep track of them, and also it's a safety thing. You need to know where they are relative to the ship so that you don't get them caught in the props and all that kind of thing. So we needed a way of tracking all these vehicles, and we also needed something that a team of roboticists from all over the world could come together and have something that we could quickly just put together and be able to track these vehicles. And so given my web background, I thought it would be a good idea to make this a web-based system. And so we set it up so that we've got it running locally on the ship, a slightly more advanced version than what we're pushing out. But given that it's web-based, it was relatively easy just to create a public site that gives updates. And we've got satellite on board, so we could push it out and we can push those updates out. So we just have a server running locally in Sydney that's getting these updates and then making them available for the world to see. I guess it started out as a requirement for something that we were doing, and then it was kind of an added bonus that we could create this public interface.
That's excellent. I saw an article this week that was talking about how Google Earth has now made it so that you can play a Pac-Man game on the streets. I just was watching the site the other day and was sort of waiting for Pac-Man to come and chomp up one of the AUVs on the website screen. But it's a really cool thing to look at, and it's really unique that it's in real time. You can see what's happening. And for those of you that are interested in looking at the site, you can access it from the Schmidt Ocean Institute website. There is a link there. But that's not the only cool tool that you've come up with on this particular cruise. We also have the Squiddle site, and I'm really excited to talk a little bit about that. What was your inspiration, and tell us a little bit about that site?
Yeah, sure. I'm excited about that one, too. Basically, we developed the Squiddle site as it was intended to be a tool to help marine scientists, because there's an issue amongst the marine science community where we collect lots of data, we give it to the marine scientists, and then they analyze it, and they're all using their own methods and own tools and doing it in different ways. And so we needed to standardize that approach, and also make our data more available. So we developed Squiddle, which puts all the data online and allows people to use a consistent, standardized framework for analyzing the data. So the classes that the marine scientists use, there's over sort of 350 classes that they choose from to do the annotation. But the reality of the situation is that there are too many images for the marine scientists to look at by themselves. And so we came up with the idea on this trip that maybe we would engage the general public to help out with the labeling process. So the nice thing there is that we get thousands and thousands and thousands. I mean, we've got actually thousands of images per dive. We've got millions of images in our repository, and most of them just used to end up in a hard drive in some marine biologist's desk, and nobody ever got to see them. So the nice thing about this public interface is people get to see images from coral reefs in remote locations all over the world, and they get to do that from behind their computer, and they also get to help out with the labeling, which is in which they can, you know, really make a difference and help science by helping out with some of the annotation. And we're not expecting that the general public will have to pick from 350 classes, so we've made a simplified interface that allows allows people to participate and to help out.
Yeah, it's a really surprisingly intuitive site. I mean, it's really easy, as I mentioned. You know, it's kind of addicting. You click on a couple points and you decide what they are, and then you move on to the next picture. You sort of want to see what's coming next, and then you want to see how many you can do. So it's almost like a challenge of how many can we get the general public to do? Do you have a goal? We should aim for a goal.
Yeah. Well, I think The more the better, really. We're going to have to set a time frame, but I think we'll keep that flexible at this point and see how we go. And we might add some more data sets if it's going well. I've already been getting some emails from some high school students showing what level they've reached and how many images they've labeled, which is kind of cool. People are kind of getting a bit competitive about it, which is nice. One student reached the level of the scientist, which I found quite impressive after only a day of labeling. So he's taking it pretty seriously.
Well, maybe we should put a competition out there, as it sounds like there's a lot of interest.
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
So, and the nice thing too is people all over the world can do that. I know that there are some classrooms here in Hawaii that have started to pay attention to the site and are working on it. And I know there's some schools in Australia. So really, you can do this from anywhere in the world.
Yeah, exactly. That's the beauty of it.
Gotta love global science. That's fantastic. And it's kind of got a funny name,
yeah.
Squiddle. Where did that? How did you come up with that name?
That's a good question. I can't really give you a simple answer to that because it was sort of a long process of picking a few different names, and we thought squids are sort of the intelligent problem solvers of the sea, or cephalopods and octopi are very intelligent problem solvers, and so we wanted to somehow include that in the name of the site, and so we thought that calling it Squiddle kind of verbified that a little bit and kind of encapsulated that a bit, so we ended up with the name Squiddle, and it seemed to sort of catch on, so we just went with it.
Well, I love it, and I'm really excited to see the outcomes of the Squiddle website. So for those of our listeners that want to learn more or want to participate in the fun image tagging project, where can they go to learn how to do it and where can they access the website?
Sure. Well, the website is hosted it's helpscience.marine.acfr.usyd.edu.au. Bit of a mouthful, but it's basically helpscience.marine at the Australian Centre for Field Robotics, that's ACFR, University of Sydney, USYD.edu.au. And then, yeah, you can do that from the comfort of your office chair sitting in front of your computer.
A good procrastination tool, might I suggest, for anybody that needs a break in the office.
Yeah.
And if you can't remember that website, we also have it on schmidtocean.org, so you can link directly to the site from there. Ari, thank you so much for your time today. I'm really excited to see the results of this expedition, not just the Squiddle site, but all the different coordinated underwater robotics that you have, and Ari and Oscar and Stefan and all of you have been able to put together on this cruise. So thank you for making some time today. I also want to give a shout out to Leighton on the ship on Falkor, as well as Tudor and Logan, who have all been very helpful with the outreach related to this cruise. And a special thank you, of course, to the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Kosi Island Earth for helping to keep all things marine going. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.